America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Hey, we're updating, redoing our website. If you go to TomHartman.com, you can click up at the very top, and you can see a couple of redesign ideas that we have, and vote. Let us know what you think, how the TomHartman.com website should be redesigned. We're actually very interested to hear your feedback on this. Going to be an interesting day here. In the first hour, we're going to be talking about unions. The folks at Chrysler have just walked out. In our second hour, we're going to ask the question, how do we stop conservatives from killing off the middle class? In our third hour, our Everything You Know Is Wrong guest Michael Gilbert is going to suggest that men have become disposable. Say what? And also, within days of his second coming, would Jesus Christ be facing charges in a number of jurisdictions across the country? Kind of following up on a conversation we had yesterday. So, but right now, Michael Bowden is with us. He is an analyst at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, the Ayn Rand Institute, of course, that group that is holding the torch of objectivism, the philosophy of Ayn Rand, the author of Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, and other publications that has become, I would suggest, the cornerstone of modern libertarianism, which has become the cornerstone of much of the modern Republican Party and conservative movement, although the objectivists over at Ayn Rand are far more pure than these polluters of the Republican Party. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Good morning. And it's, right, I think you said Michael Bowden, and it is Thomas. I was wondering how you could forget that name.
Yeah, my apologies.
All right.
Rick Wagner, who is, or Wagoner, I guess it's pronounced, is the CEO of GM. He just doubled his salary to $9.3 million this year from last year. At the same time, the top CEO of Toyota, which has now surpassed GM as one of the largest manufacturers of cars in the world, Hiroshi Okuda, earned $903,000 last year, one-tenth, roughly, of what the CEO of GM is. At the same time, the workers of GM and now Chrysler has gone out on strike today. At the same time, the workers are increasingly feeling that they're getting screwed. You guys are taking the position, and Ron Paul took it last night. In fact, I'll play the clip for our listeners after we take a break, but I'm sure you'd agree that, you know, it's a fine thing to have an auto union or any kind of union. It's fine for people to get together, but they shouldn't have any rights. In other words, they shouldn't have rights enforced by the government. For example, the right to go on strike and the employer cannot replace them. Am I getting that correct?
Well, it's not that unions have no rights. It's they don't have rights given to them by the government that are not their individual rights to start with. Certainly, unions in a free country can organize and go on strike, but businesses have the equal freedom to replace them if they go on strike. And what we have under the National Labor Relations Act is a situation where the two parties have to deal with each other. You're locked in step with a union and a business, and there's no freedom of contract anymore.
Right. What the National Labor Relations Act has done and did back in 1935, the Wagner Act, is it gave unions certain powers relative to corporations. I'm just curious about what your concern is. If you're concerned about that, are you also concerned about the powers that corporations have? That if I start a corporation, and I have, in fact, I own a corporation, I have limited liability in a whole variety of ways. I have a completely different tax code. I can write off meals. I can write off health insurance. I can't do that as an individual. I can as a corporation. Corporations, I guess the bottom line here question is if government is going to provide all of these protections to organized capital, why should government not provide protections to organized labor?
Well, when you ask the question that way, there's really no answer to it. I'm against corporate welfare.
I'm not talking about corporate welfare. I'm talking about corporate existence. We bring corporations into existence by act of law. Corporations as a unique entity exist by legislative fiat. We created that form. We the people.
Yeah.
Without all these protections for corporations, what you'd have is basically sole proprietorships and individual
laborers. I'm for laissez-faire capitalism. corporations are not a privilege. To form a corporation is a right, the same way as getting married is a right. You have to get a marriage license. You register your marriage with the government. That's all corporations should have to do. Every power that a corporation has is an outgrowth of its right to enter into contracts with other consenting adults. So there are
why?
No special powers.
Where in the Constitution does it say corporations have rights?
Oh, it doesn't say that in the Constitution. It says individuals have rights. Corporations are made up of individuals who are entering into contracts to form organizations.
So it's a labor union. It's made up of individuals.
Yeah, and they have their right to contract, too, to contract within the union, to join and to obey certain rules, and then they can enter into contracts with businesses.
So you think that the protections that are given to corporations to participate in the economy in ways that are unique from the protections that are given to individuals, for example, different tax codes, should be done away with?
Yeah, anything that's not an outgrowth of individual rights should be done away with. I mean, the tax.
So a corporation shouldn't be able to deduct from their taxes the cost of doing business.
You can get rid of the whole tax code, as far as I'm concerned, for individuals, corporations, unions, and everybody.
Yeah. Thomas Bowden, I have to submit to you that what it sounds like you're advocating is anarchy.
Well, no, not anarchy. Government has a legitimate function in connection with what we've been talking about to enforce contracts. If you make a contract and then the union breaks it or the company breaks it, then either party should have a right to go to court and enforce it.
But you have to define what the parameters of those contracts are.
You've got to have courtrooms. You've got to have police. You've got to have a military to defend the country. These are all functions of government that protect individual rights, but, you know, government has become the chief violator of individual rights. And that's
so back to the original question, what is wrong with capital organizing it? Well, actually, let's take it to a larger frame. What's wrong with we the people collectively through a democratic government saying we believe that one of the things that will bring about a middle class, which we believe is a desirable outcome, is for labor to be able to organize and to have some power relative to capital, that is, relative to corporations. For example, the right to force them to negotiate with labor as opposed to simply firing them. What's wrong with our having passed that into law in 1935?
Well, labor should have the right to organize, but when you go beyond that and say give them some power to force business to deal with them, that's wrong in principle for the same reason that it's wrong for the government to force you to decide who you're going to have as guests on your program, for the same reason it's wrong to force businesses to hire certain quotas of individuals.
But there's an intrinsic imbalance of power here. A corporation has enormous amounts of money and power, and an individual doesn't.
Well, you're confusing economic power and political power. If you take political power
no,
out
I'm
of
conflating
the equation,
them.
If you take
you
the
can't
power
do that.
Of a they... gun out of the equation, then corporations have no more power than what each individual freely gives them by buying their product. So they earn.
But the fact, you look at 7,000 years of the history of Western civilization, and you see that consistently it is the wealthy and the powerful who have controlled the governments, and the governments have acted by and large on behalf of the wealthy and the powerful. That's the laissez-faire capitalism that you're advocating. That's the world that Charles Dickens wrote about.
No, it's time to get government out of the hands of the wealthy and powerful and anybody who has the pull to use government to violate other people's rights.
Then how do we protect ourselves from the wealthy and powerful?
The government will do it. That's the government.
But you just said get government out of that.
I say get the. You're talking about the wealthy and powerful using their influence to get
using their economic power to wipe out the middle class and turn us all into serfs. How do you do that without the force of government?
Well, again, you got to keep separate economic power and political power. There should be no.
I am suggesting to you can't.
Well,
can you give me one example in the 7,000 years of history of laissez-faire capitalism where what you're advocating actually worked?
Well, that's why I say it. We're providing the ideas for the revolution that's yet to come. This is the revolution of individual rights and capitalism, where you will achieve separation of economics and state for the same reasons that you have separation of church and state.
And you begin by stripping the power from labor to to force the capital to negotiate with
them. You can start by stripping it those powers from business if you want. Just as long as you promise to keep going and strip them from everybody, then I'm with you.
Okay, Thomas Bowden, AynRand.org, the website, an analyst focusing on legal issues at the Ayn Rand Institute. Good talking with you, Thomas. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
It's 16 minutes past the hour. We'll hear from Ron Paul, the former Libertarian candidate for president, now running as a Republican. The same issue. Should we, you know, what about labor unions? Right after this.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
The bottom line is the economy here to serve we the people, or are we the people here to serve the economy, and therefore, by implication, those who own the economy? USA Today reporting, Sharon Carty in USA Today, writing, Chrysler's new CEO, Bob Nardelli, became a symbol of corporate excess when he left Home Depot early this year with a $210 million severance package. Ford's new CEO, Alan Mulally, got a $27.8 million salary and bonus in his first few months on the job, including an $18.5 million signing bonus. Meanwhile, workers are getting screwed, and they're going out on strike. Now, the Republican perspective on this, and it was very interesting last night. Chris Matthews asked a number of the Republican candidates, what's your position on labor unions? And they all said essentially the same thing, which sounded really nice. It's almost like everybody had gotten together and fine-tuned this. And here's Ron Paul's statement on this. But notice how he says they should not have any special rights. Words, sure, you should have the right to organize, but not... You should not have the right, and this is the Republican position, that unions should not have the right to use the force of government to balance the power of corporations. In other words, they should not have the right to prevent a corporation from simply firing all of them and replacing them, bringing in scab workers, that kind of thing. But they say it in a way that just sounds so nice that I'll bet most of the people listening didn't even catch it. Listen. Actually... Got to make the thing work here.
Are unions good for America? And please act like you're a member of a union and limit it to 30 seconds. Okay? I'll start with Congressman Paul. Please, we have to limit the time.
The right to unionize should be a basic right of any group. You should be able to organize. You should have no privileges, no special benefits legislated to benefit the unions. But you should never deny any working group to organize and negotiate for the best set of standards of working conditions.
You get that? See, the key to the whole thing is, yeah, fine, you can have a union, but you can't have any power.
Privileges, no special benefits legislated to benefit the unions, but you should never...
See, there you go. You should have no special privileges. You should have no special benefits. Oh, sure, you guys can have a union all day. Yeah, you can have a ladies' sewing circle, too. You can organize. You can have the Loyal Order of the Moose. We don't care, just so long as you don't want to ask for power. Because if you're going to take on power, if you're going to take on the economic royalists, as Franklin Roosevelt called them, then you've got a problem. Then you've got a problem. And every single Republican essentially said what Ron Paul said. Sure, yeah, we think unions are wonderful. Just don't give them any power. Franklin Roosevelt would have had something to say about that, I think.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power.
And see, that's the bottom line.
Our allegiance.
Their power and their paycheck.
And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
And Franklin Roosevelt said that just about 6 months after the Wagner Act was passed, which gave unionized workers the right to organize into a union and to stand up to corporate power, to the economic royalists that FDR talked about. Much of the history of the United States has been the history of the robber barons, essentially, of the Gilded Age. We saw this from Reconstruction, from after the Civil War, right up until the Republican Great Depression in 1929. And then we had the New Deal era that started in the 1930s and led right up to Ronald Reagan, 1980. And every other country in the world, every other developed country in the world, industrialized country in the world, pretty much went along the same way. We were all moving in the direction that Franklin Roosevelt moved the United States. And most of your European countries, many South American countries, Japan certainly, Taiwan, South Korea, most of these countries are saying, no, we're going to do what's going to build a strong middle class. We're going to give unions power. We're going to give unions the ability to fight back. But in 1947, the Republicans declared war on organized labor, passing the Taft-Hartley Act. Harry Truman vetoed it, but the Republicans had taken control of both the House and the Senate in the elections of 46, and they overrode his veto. And the Taft-Hartley Act, this providing for the so-called right-to-work states and cutting other powers, frankly, that unions had been given in 1935 in the Wagner Act. And that was, by the way, 47 was the peak year of unionization in the United States. 35% of the American workforce was unionized. It's down to 7% of our private workforce now. So the question, should their rights be dictated and terminated by only the free market? Is there even such a thing as the free market? If capital can organize, why can't labor? Isn't this really about democracy in the workplace? That's what a union is, democracy in the workplace. And I'd say that people who are opposed to unions are opposed to democracy, bottom line, and the middle class. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
The Republicans are in deep space. Say, speaking of deep space, yes, Rudy Giuliani yesterday in the Republican debate said that the United States has disrupted 23 terrorist attacks since 9/11. Not quite the number the Bush administration is touting. Not even close. But 23 is the number of times Giuliani also says he's cut taxes in New York. So maybe he's just kind of, you know, losing it. Not unlike, this is interesting. Here's, of course, good old Admiral Stockdale.
Who am I? Why am I here?
Remember him, Ross Perot's running mate? Here's Fred Thompson. This isn't from last night, it's from a few weeks ago, but same context.
Who is this guy and why is he here?
Yeah, good old Grandpa Fred. Well, he didn't fall asleep last night, but that's, I think, about all you can say about it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Also up at the top, we've got a survey. We're redesigning our website, and we would love to get your feedback on it. No prizes or surprises or anything. Just, you know, appreciate your thoughts. And airamerica.com if you want to participate in our blogs. Michael in Ohio. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air, Michael.
Hi. Yeah, I caught the tail end of your conversation with the other caller, and I thought you were speaking of Corporation of Souls, you know, individuals in the United States that don't pay taxes due to loopholes in the Constitution. But listening further, you know, that's not germane to the conversation. But in listening to you, basically what I take from what you're saying is that basically the industrial base is the hierarchy, and we're serfdom, you know, middle class and lower class citizens, basically working in a different form of a field and being paid what they deem we should be paid. Is what it sounds like, you know, you're stating on the radio.
That's the essence of it, Michael, and thank you. And in fact, I thought it was interesting. The moderator last night, she asked a question. She started out this question by saying, and I think this went to Fred Thompson. In fact, my recollection is this was the very beginning of the debate. Is that in this clip here? It's not in the clip. Okay. So I can't play the audio of it, but she started the debate by turning to Fred Thompson and saying, the economy is the greatest thing about America. Well, frankly, first of all, I don't think the economy is the greatest thing about America. I think the greatest thing about America is 230 some odd years of idealism, is our Constitution, is the values upon which we're founded, is our people. Our people are the greatest thing about America. But I guess you would expect somebody from CNBC, from a news agency or news organization that's devoted to business, to think that the economy is the best thing about America. But in any case, in answer to your comment, Michael, my point is, if we are going to say, we the people collectively, through our democratic institutions, through government, which we own and we control, and we hire people to represent us there, we vote for them, are like the representatives. If we, the people, are going to say that we think it's so good and so important that people be allowed to do business in the United States, and in fact encouraged to do business in the United States, and we do, there's a broad consensus about that. I don't know of anybody, well, actually, the Communist Party of the United States of America arguably is opposed to this, but I'm not opposed to it. I think, you know, right across the board, left, right, middle, you know, there's a broad consensus. Yes, we want to encourage business. It's a positive thing. It's a net positive for us. So if we're going to give special privileges, special powers to the aggregation of capital, to people pulling together money to create a business, we're going to give them the ability, for example, to deduct from their income taxes certain costs of doing business, the cost of advertising, the cost of goods, the cost of marketing, the cost of employees. We're going to give them the ability to deduct the cost of health care. We're going to, you know, and on and on. If we're going to give them limited liability, both from lawsuits and from bankruptcy, for example. If we're going to do that, if we're going to give all these special rights and privileges to businesses because we think it's a good thing that business be able to operate in this country, and we do, then shouldn't we also give balancing rights and power to labor? Because the whole reason why we're saying it's a good thing for business to do business in the United States is because ultimately people get paychecks out of it. In other words, the reason, the big picture, and this is what was completely missed by every single Republican last night in the debate, and I would submit to you all of the Democrats get, is that the reason that we want there to be business being done in this country is so that people can take a paycheck, and that paycheck, you know, helps create a middle class, and that creates, you know, life is good in the United States. It's a good thing. And you're not going to have that if labor doesn't have power. You're not going to have that if there are no labor unions. Mike in Virginia, listening to WVAX. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, just in a time in response to a gentleman that you had a few minutes ago. You know, I'm a third generation union member and proud of it. And I raised five kids on union wages. My wife also worked for 20 years. So, you know, that just shows you the income that we needed to raise five kids. It was my wife and I both had to work. But, you know, these companies are not going to pay their employees living wages and quality of life benefits and wages out of the goodness of their hearts.
No, the only thing that'll cause them to do it is if they are forced to do it, and labor requires the power of government in order to be part of that force. Let's just be very candid and honest about it, and even use the language that the libertarians and Republicans use, where they say government is guys with guns, it's force, it's a terrible thing. I'm saying no. Yes, government is guys with guns and it's force, and it's a good thing because that's what it's going to take to protect labor.
That's exactly right. And it really kills me when you go to Walmart and places and they call their employees associates. Those people are no more associates to the Walton family than I am a hunting partner to Dick Cheney.
Yeah, there you go. And you wouldn't want to be one anyway.
Absolutely
Mike, thanks
not.
A lot. It's very, very well said. Yeah, no, spot on. My father raised four boys with working in a union shop and a tool and die shop in Lansing, Michigan. It's a tragedy that this is how it's. I mean, I opened my book Screwed. The first chapter is about my dad. How ultimately he got screwed by the system too. Anyhow, Andrew in Tenafly, New Jersey. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking a call. Your guests don't seem to realize that the reason why the rules and regulations were there is because of abuses in the industry and the corporations. It's not the government had the vision that these things are going to happen, whether it be environmental laws, labor laws. If you look back, corporations abused them.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
This is the rise of the robber barons. There's a reason why they were referred to as the robber barons, and it was a very, very terrible time for America. The so-called golden age or gilded age from the 1870s up until 1929, until the Great Republican Great Depression. If you look at the census of 1900, we do a census every 10 years. The average income in the United States, inflation adjusted to today's dollars. The average income in the United States was $9,700 a year. That's what most workers were making. The only middle class that existed in the United States for all practical purposes in 1900 were individual small family farmers. That was it. And then you had, some mercantilists. You had some, small business owners and doctors and lawyers and whatnot. But that was it. I mean, the middle class was pretty much non-existent. And the middle class came into being in the United States and Canada and Europe as a result of the power of unions, and in large part. Andrew, thank you for the call. Stuart in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Stuart.
Hey, Tom. What I wanted to comment on was that earlier you had mentioned that the guy you had on your show was saying that what his idea was anarchy. And I just couldn't help but think, that's what he was suggesting was supply and demand, not anarchy.
It would be supply and demand, except for the fact that on the corporate side, you're allowing people to aggregate what is essentially power. Money can be particularly large amounts of money represents power, and there's no way to say, oh well, we're going to separate corporate power from business power or from government power. You can't do it. And even if you tried, still corporate power in and of itself. I mean, try telling your insurance company you don't think that they're treating you well. Try telling the phone company you don't like the service you're getting from them. And that kind of power is substantial. And I'm saying there needs to be balancing power on the labor side.
What you're suggesting, it sounds like, is back to the Middle Ages, where a king decides how much certain products are. I mean, you gotta.
No, I'm not trying to fix the price of products. What I am suggesting, though, is that we should fix at least a minimum floor for the price of labor. And during the time of the kings in Europe, by the way, there were maximum wage laws. Right up until the 1780s in the United States, we had maximum wage laws. It was one of the things that the revolution was fought over. In other words, to prevent a middle class from emerging. But Stuart, you're absolutely right, by the way, about supply and demand. And I'll riff on that just a little bit when we come back from the break, because this is one of the things that unions have historically fought for, is to limit the supply of labor to increase the demand for it. And that, again, is what brings about a middle class. It's why they fought for child labor laws. They didn't want competition from children. It's why they fought against illegal immigration in the 1880s. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
That's right.
Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors who keep us on the air. Great folks like Small Dog Electronics and Sacred Grounds Coffee and the Organic Wine Company and Purina One Natural Blends and KY Jelly Advertising. It was a surprise to hear their ad yesterday after our debate, but anyhow, strange stuff going on, but support our advertisers. Thank you very much. In particular, our local advertisers. Be sure and be out there supporting them. Uh-oh. Crocodiles. This is from the journal Bioscience. New article in Bioscience. They find, you know the phrase crocodile tears? Crocodile tears? Turns out crocodiles actually do cry crocodile tears when they're eating. When they're tearing flesh apart, their eyes are bubbling and foaming. Nobody's sure why. They think maybe it has to do with all the heavy breathing that they're doing, you know, blowing air out through their, around their eyes as well as out their nose. But anyhow, so that's our crocodile alert for the day. 1-866-303-2270. Debbie in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Debbie.
Hi, Tom.
Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking
Hello.
My call.
Sure.
Tom, one thing I wanted to share with you is that this is something I've thought about in the pattern that the way our country has been developing over the past 20-some years. I have a theory that just as the Soviet Union imploded back in 91, runaway communism couldn't sustain itself. Well, in the same way that that imploded and fell apart, my view is that this country is headed in the same direction with runaway capitalism, that cannot sustain itself and will evolve and we will implode and it will have to change.
This is what happened in 29. And oddly enough, Ron Paul, who is a libertarian, who would be one of the biggest advocates for runaway capitalism, was pointing out the exact consequences of this. Let's remember, and Debbie, thank you so much for bringing this up. Let's remember that in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected president, the United States was the largest exporter of finished goods in the world and the largest importer of raw materials. We brought in stuff, raw materials, and we exported products. We were the largest creditor to the world. More people owed us money than any other nation in the world. We were the wealthiest nation in the world. Now, 26 years later, 26 years of Reaganism, 26 years of rejecting the New Deal, of just blowing off the New Deal, because that's really what happened. I mean, that's really the bottom line.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And they have. For 26 years, they have done something about that. Roosevelt's policies that built America as the strongest nation in the world, we are now no longer the largest exporter of finished goods and largest importer of raw material. We have reversed. We are now the largest exporter of raw materials. We are being strip mined by the world. Our gold, our minerals, our wood is all being shipped overseas, and we are the largest importer of finished goods. We have become a banana republic. We have gone from being the largest creditor in the world, that is the largest more people owing us money, the largest lender in the world, to becoming the largest debtor in the world. We are the most indebted nation in the world. And Ron Paul talking about this last night.
Right now, we owe foreigners $2.7 trillion. No wonder they have money to come back in here and buy stuff up, and then we object. But that has to do with our monetary system as well as our foreign policy. So if we want prosperity, we have to change our foreign policy. We have to live within our means. But we can't maintain a reserve currency where all our greatest export today are paper dollars. We create money out of thin air, and they still accept it as if it was backed by gold. And that is the reason all this money goes overseas, and at the same time we finance all this military activity overseas. It's bankrupting this country. And not only that, it's a threat to our personal liberties here, and it's going to be a threat to our economy because we are beginning to live beneath our means.
Yeah, well, and Ron Paul is half right. He's half right. But his solution would be to just get government out of the business of all this stuff altogether and just throw the doors open to the multinational corporations and everything's fine. That's not going to work. That's what we've been doing for the last 26 years, more or less, and it ain't working. It just ain't working. Hans in San Diego, California. Hey, Hans.
Hey, Tom. You know, I was going to talk about something you're leading into very well, which is self-regulation. Corporations constantly want to lead the American people and sell to the American people that they can self-regulate. And self-regulation is the best way for economy. Self-regulation is the best way for this administration to continue to say that it's running, that, as Bush said, he's going to run the government as a corporation. And he's going to self-regulate, and he is showing us exactly that.
Yes, exactly. Self-regulation means there's no rules.
Correct. Yeah. And this is a huge hazard to us. And I know that you've elaborated on this in some manner in your book.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Hans. You're absolutely right. And well said. We just have a minute here left to try and get a couple quick calls in. Gary in West Deptford, New Jersey. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that I've been listening to your show, and it kind of falls right into like my situation. I have like over 20 years in retail, and I've got nothing to show for it. I've got no pension.
I'm guessing your employer does not allow unions.
Well, actually, what's happening is I am now trying to start a union. I work for Office Depot, and as far as I know, I'm the only one in the country trying to do this, trying to start a union. And, of course, I've had many visits to the manager's office for it.
Yeah, I would guess, Gary, that you're not the only one in the country. But this is a billion-dollar-a-year industry. I mean, literally, a billion-dollar-a-year industry right now, telling corporations how to prevent people from unionizing. We're going to stay on this topic for another hour, only expand it a little bit into the realm of how do we prevent conservatives from completely killing off the middle class. Unions are the core of the middle class, but there's more to it than that. How do we prevent the conservatives from totally wiping us up?
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
So Chrysler's going out on strike today. A reasonable first step. Their new CEO, Bob Nardelli, the guy who walked away with a $210 million severance package from Home Depot, not a union shop. Now he's got a union shop to deal with. Good luck. Ford's new CEO making $27.8 million in his first few months on the job, plus an $18.5 million signing bonus. Oh, but we can't afford to pay the workers. Just can't afford to do it. But this is only the tip of the iceberg of the destruction of the American middle class. It really and truly is only the tip of the iceberg. The fact of the matter is, and this is the thing that most people don't get, this is absolutely what the Republicans don't want you to know, or what conservatives don't want you to know, I should say, because there are some Democrats who fall into this category as well, and certainly the libertarians. And that is that it is not normal for there to be a middle class. Because we had a strong middle class in the United States for about 40 years, from the 1940s, the mid to late 1940s, through the mid-1980s, until Reagan's economic policies really started to take bite about 1984, 85, 86, with a big recession, I believe, of 84, as I recall, as a consequence of his tax cuts and his union busting and everything else. I would say in particular his tax cuts. because we had this 40-year period of a strong middle class, and there's still an echo of it, we still have the appearance of it. It's been largely hollowed out, but it still looks like a middle class. You drive down neighborhoods, and you see people living in houses, and you think, oh, gee, this is the middle class. Well, 40 years ago, you drove down those same streets and saw those people living in those houses, and they owned their houses. They had 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100% equity in their house. Nowadays, you drive down those streets, and you see people who have gone to three different refi places, and they have zero equity, in some cases negative equity. They own more on their house than it's worth. They owe more than it's worth. The same thing with their cars. Used to be, you see people driving their cars around. Most people bought their cars. They bought it at the most if they were financing it over 2 or 3 years. Now people are leasing. They're renting their cars. So it's like we don't own stuff anymore, which is called wealth. There's a difference between wealth and income. Wealth is what you have. Income is what's coming in, right? And one of the reasons why we don't have the wealth any longer, the middle class of America doesn't have as much wealth as it used to, why our savings rate last year went negative, is because in real inflation-adjusted terms, our income has been dropping ever since Ronald Reagan became president. The income of everybody, if you pull off the top 1% of wage earners and you look at the other 99% of wage earners, income has been steadily dropping ever since Ronald Reagan. And this is the thing that people don't get. Because we had this middle class for so long, people think that this must be the normal state of affairs. No, a middle class is not normal. Look at 7,000 years, going all the way back to Gilgamesh and the founding of what we call modern Western civilization in Mesopotamia, the Epic of Gilgamesh in northern Iraq, through the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, the Dutch trading companies, the settlement of the United States. Look through this, that 7,000 year history. Look at the 4,000 or 5,000 year history of China. Look at the arguably 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 year history of India. Look at any civilization. Look at the Mayas and the Incas back 7,000 to 10,000 years. Look at any of them. And what you'll see is that, without exception, there was never a substantial middle class. It was always a small number of very wealthy and powerful people and a lot of very poor people and a very small middle class. The middle class were the doctors and the small shop owners, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, but they were small in number. A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens' book about Scrooge and Marley and Bob Cratchit. Scrooge and Marley was the company. Marley was dead. Scrooge was actually the middle class. He was a small business owner. So there was this very small and powerful, wealthy elite that ruled England during the Victorian era when Dickens was writing. In fact, his father was thrown into a debtor's jail, debtor's prison, by these people. And then there was the middle class, a very small middle class, the Ebenezer Scrooges, small business owners who might have one or two employees like Scrooge did. And then there was everybody else. Everybody else was Bob Cratchit. That was like 95% of the population. And in fact, if you look at European history, there have only been three times when a middle class has emerged. And each time it has emerged as a consequence of an abnormality in the relationship between wealth and labor, or supply and demand of labor, to use a phrase from a caller in the last hour. The first was after the Black Death, the great bubonic plague of the 1400s. Or is it the 14th century, the 1300s? I forget which it was. But in any case, the Black Plague wiped out a third of the population of Europe. And as a consequence of that, the four or five generations that followed, a middle class emerged in Europe. Why? Because so many laborers were killed off that the demand for labor increased. And so the cost of labor increased. So people who had been serfs before were now able to be the middle class. They were able to charge more for their labor. And what happened when that middle class emerged? Right after the plagues, when the population of Europe collapsed by a third. What happened? The Renaissance. Because people had time. They had time to think. They had time to talk about politics. They had time to create music. They had time for art. They had time for family. They had time to travel. They had disposable incomes. It created the Renaissance. And there was this brief period of about four or five generations until the population reached again the norm where the population exceeded the supply of labor, exceeded the demand for labor. And thus, as David Ricardo pointed out in his 1816 masterpiece on labor, the norm is that when the supply of labor equals or slightly exceeds the demand for labor, which is normal in most cases, the cost of labor will fall to what Ricardo referred to as a subsistence level. In other words, serfdom. The working poor is what we call it today. The working poor is what is normal. So Europe went back to the working poor four generations after the Black Plague. And then in the 1600s, there was another abnormality, another disturbance in the force, in the economic force. A disturbance in Adam Smith's invisible hand. And that was that the Europeans started stealing massive amounts of gold from indigenous people in Central and South America. And all this wealth was flowing into Europe, and it did trickle down to a large extent. There was so much wealth at the top that the people at the top were saying, hey, we want to build mansions, we want to build houses, we want to build churches, we want to build cities, and we need more labor to do that. And there wasn't that much labor around, and so the cost of labor went up. And as the cost of labor went up, a middle class emerged. And we refer to that period of time, the 1600s, as the Enlightenment. And it brought about thinkers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau in France and John Locke in England. And it led directly to the creation of the United States of America, which, by the way, was another emergence of a middle class, again, because of an abnormality. Europeans came over here. They brought diseases with them that killed off millions of Native Americans, and then they physically murdered millions of Native Americans, took their land, and brought in slaves. And between the slaves and the free land, there was so much wealth relative to the number of people that a middle class emerged. And what did that middle class do? It created the American Revolution. But then the middle class vanished after the Civil War. We didn't have a middle class in the United States from about 1870 until around 1940. And if you can find somebody old enough to remember that time or go back and read the histories of it, you will hear those stories. You can see what it was like. And it was not good. And that's why the progressive and populist movements emerged in the 1880s. It's why the union movement emerged in the 1880s to try to drive up the cost of labor to try and rebuild the American middle class. So the middle class came about in the 1940s as a result of Franklin Roosevelt saying, we're going to intervene. We're not going to use a plague, and we're not going to steal money from indigenous people. We're going to intervene with government in the economy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. You get it. A middle class is not a normal thing. The only way that you're going to have a middle class is if there's a severe disruption in the availability of labor relative to the demand for it, or vice versa. You know, greater demand or a diminished supply, which is what labor unions do. They constrict the supply of labor. This is why the 40-hour work week. If people work fewer hours, you need more people. It drives up the demand for labor, drives up the price of labor. So all of these interventions that the conservatives hate, that Franklin Roosevelt brought about, minimum wage laws, maximum hour laws, the right to unionize, Social Security, Medicare. Now, that wasn't Franklin Roosevelt's. That came from Lyndon Johnson. But the first guy to propose a national health care system, a national single-payer health care system, was Harry Truman in 1947. And the Republicans in the House of Representatives and the Senate shot it down. But Social Security and Medicare, these are the things that built the American middle class, and these are the things that will maintain it. And the conservatives don't want there to be a middle class, because what has happened during the two periods of time in the United States when we've had a strong middle class, in the 1770s and the 1970s? In both cases, you had people standing up and demanding their rights, and you saw the power and the wealth, the actual ownership of total assets. Paul Krugman writes about this brilliantly, by the way, in his new book. You saw the wealth of Americans draw of the top 0.01%, the economic elites in this country, drop by a half. And they're just like, we can't have this. And so there was the coup of the elites. And so the Republican Party is representing the interests of the DLC wing of the Democratic Party, representing the interests of these economic elites. And this is Fred Thompson in the Republican debate last night talking about this. I mean, again, this is all about destroying Social Security. You want to solve Social Security and Medicare? Just do away with the cap so that Bill Gates and I are paying the exact same percentage of our income in Social Security taxes. It's real simple. Or so that Fred Thompson and I are paying the same percentage. But he's not going to address it that way.
Give specific steps to maintain long-term solvency of Social Security. Describe some of those specific steps.
Yeah. Well, you've hit on a major problem that we've got to come to terms with. We're looking at the short-term economic situation now, and I think it's very good news. But if you go out a little bit, you'll see that we're not going to have Social Security and Medicare as we know it into the future. Our children and our grandchildren certainly are not.
Yeah, because the Republicans want to do away with it. I mean, it's just very simple. This is a system that would be very easy to fix with a very small adjustment. Doing away with the cap, or as John Edwards has suggested, putting a donut hole above the cap. Right now, if you make over $97,000 a year, you don't pay into the Social Security Trust Fund. And so he says, okay, if you make over $250,000 a year, you start paying back into it again. So let's recapture the millionaires and billionaires and let them pay into the Social Security Trust Fund so that once again, all of us, particularly those of us who have done very well, are helping all of us. So all of us are in it with all of us. The idea that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link really should be the nation's, you know, our national mantra, rather than I got mine. Speaking of I got mine, 9 Republican congressmen now have announced that they're not going to be running for re-election. For example, Ray LaHood, the Republican from Illinois, he says, you know, why he's retiring. He says that the Democrats do 5-day work week. Speaking of limiting labor. He says, I do think the schedule and the flying is a huge pain for people, particularly those from the Midwest or even further west. It's probably the worst part of the job. I think that has played into these retirement announcements. Jack Kingston, the Republican from Georgia, he's griping about working 5 days a week. He says, marriages suffer. The Democrats could care less about families. That's what this says. You recall when John Boehner was running the House of Representatives, the House was working only a 3-day work week. Now under Nancy Pelosi, they're working a 5-day work week. It's got the Republicans all upset. All upset. So anyhow, the bottom line here, what I'm seeing is the planned and controlled implosion and destruction of the American middle class by conservatives who control the Republican Party and have significant influence in the Democratic Party. And something that if we don't do something about it, if we don't wake up the American people, that no, a middle class is not a normal thing. And if you do have that wonderful deregulation that all the Republicans are talking about, and let's get rid of those lawsuits. God forbid we have lawsuits. And let's unfetter corporations, and let's have more free trade. All this stuff that sounds like freedom. If you do that, there will be no middle class left in America. Outside of the occasional doctor or lawyer. That's going to be it. You will have nobody except CEOs like the guy who's the head of Chrysler who walks away with a $210 million compensation package from his last job, and you'll have people working for $6 an hour. and there'll be nothing in between. Which is, by the way that the conservatives would like it, because it leads to, in their mind, and really it does, leads to social stability. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Attitude is we're taking back America. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Our number 866-303-2270. Get to your calls in just a second. First, just a very quick one I wanted to share with you, also from the Republican debates last night. This rather boggled my mind. Asking the Republicans, would you have to go to Congress in order to before attacking Iran? Would you have to go to Congress before attacking Iran? And, you know, apparently the candidates for president of the United States on the Republican side have never read the Constitution. Here we are. Article 1, which is the powers granted to Congress, Section 8. The Congress shall have the power to, and then you jump down to Line 11, to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. This is a power solely vested with Congress. The executive branch does not have the power to make war. So Mitt Romney was asked, if you wanted to make war with Iran, would you go to Congress?
Governor Romney, that raises the question, if you were president of the United States, would you need to go to Congress to get authorization to take military action against Iran's nuclear facilities?
You sit down with your attorneys and tell you what you have to do, but obviously the President of the United States has to do what's in the best interest of the United States to this.
No, I'm sorry, he doesn't. The President of the United States has to do what the Constitution says he has to do. Yeah, hopefully he thinks it's in the best interest of the United States, as Ron Paul called him on.
This idea of going and talking to attorneys totally baffles me. Why don't we just open up the Constitution and read it? You're not allowed to go to war without a declaration of war.
This is really rather simple. And Ron Paul also going off on this. And again, as I said, I am very concerned about Ron Paul. If he was in charge of this country, you would never see a middle class. It would be totally wiped out because the guy's a libertarian. And yet, he's making more sense than most of the Republicans.
The thought that the Iranians could pose an imminent attack on the United States is preposterous. There's no way. This is just this is just war propaganda. Continued war propaganda, preparing this nation to go to war and spread this war not only in Iraq but into Iran unconstitutionally. It is a road to disaster for us as a nation. It's a road to our financial disaster if we don't read the Constitution.
Yeah, read the Constitution once in a while. It would be a fine thing. Will in Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Will, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you? I love your show. Great show, really. I'm going to ask something. I know it's going to sound real gloomy, but just hang in there with me, okay? Because I don't think I'm the only one that feels this way. I kind of, like, with all the corporate control we have now and control by the media, by demigods like Murdoch, I can't help but feel that America, we are sort of akin to Rome right before the throes of the fall. And honestly, short of an armed uprising, I don't think this can be fixed. I know that sounds crazy, but to me it's not crazy. I mean, they, being the right wing, despite what they say to the contrary, really control everything.
Yeah, this is, but see, here's the point, Will. What you're saying is to a large extent true. And it's the exact same thing that Americans were saying in the 1920s about William Randolph Hearst owning, you know, a good chunk of the media. I mean, he even, you know, essentially cut a deal with McKinley to help start the Spanish-American War, about the robber barons, the you know, Samuel Huntington and the railroads, Jay Gould, J.P. Morgan, Kennedy. I mean, you know, you had a small economic aristocracy that was running this country and had for close to a half a century, more than half a century, arguably. And people thought, there's no way that we can get around this. And Franklin Roosevelt came along and said, no, we are going to put an end to this. We are going to bust this up. Now, granted, the Republican Great Depression gave some popular support to that idea. And, you know, God forbid another, Republican Great Depression come along and cause this. But, you know, that's frankly what I think we're far more on the edge of than anything else. But I'm not willing to despair, Will. I get it that when Americans experience enough abuse, essentially, at the hands of these folks, and we've done it before, that we reach out to our leaders and we say, no, we want you to take a strong leadership role. And that's what they said to Franklin Roosevelt, and that's what he did. And let's also keep in mind that he wasn't elected in 1932 on a platform of doing the New Deal. He was elected on a very, very modest, moderate platform, and he became one of America's greatest reformers, arguably the greatest reformer in the history of this country. So I'm not despairing about it, but I get your point, and it's something that we need to constantly be pointing to, and it is the a great concern. Alan in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Alan.
Hey, Tom. Good morning to you. I love your show. If we had 1,000 more like you, and maybe we wouldn't have any of these problems. I've got a couple of points of disagreement with you. One, the battle against the middle class has not been going on for 26 years. It's been going on for a lot longer than that.
It's been going on since the beginning of time.
That's right. Let's smash them down. I'm a former union official, and I was very proud to have the nickname of management's irritant, to have the nickname of trouble, because every time I came up, I represented one thing, and I represented the workers, because you have crummy work conditions. Let's try to remember why unions came into being, because of child labor. Sure, you can argue the point that if we're going to control labor and have a limited market, I'd rather pay an 8-year-old kid to do it than an adult. But the child labor laws, the factories that were on fire, we can go on and on and on.
Oh, yeah, the garment workers in New York who were chained in and died, all those women, and there was a great fire, as I recall, in the 1920s. The Pullman cars strike, you know, it's the Haymarket Square riots. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, all the way back to Joe Hill in the 1880s being convicted and given the death sentence, as I recall, in Salt Lake City, wasn't it?
Yes, it was Salt Lake City where they finally did it. One of the problems now is that when I'm talking about union officials, and the union that I was in, I was considered fairly radical. When I use such words as neo-corporate fascists, my articles for the local Northwest Labor Press were censored. Whoa! Yeah. I really love that. Why? Because these jackboot-wearing son of a bees want to keep us down. It's very Marxian to me, although I don't believe in a total Marxist state, but it's very Marxian. We need a pool of cheap labor. Okay, that's what the conservatives say. And the economic growth that we're having is fantastic. Why? 23 more McDonald's opened up, and we're paying you $7.85 an hour to support your family of four.
Yeah. So and truth be told, this is, I had Andy Stern on this program a while ago and got in essentially a fight with him on the air. He's all gung-ho on free trade and all this stuff, and unions are embracing, let's bring in as many, let's do away with immigration laws and let's bring in as many people into the country as possible. And I'm like, you guys are cutting your own throats. You're absolutely cutting your own throats. You can't get in bed with these corporations, and you can't do the dance that the conservatives are doing just because it seems like the popular thing this week, or because it's going to get you more members over the short term, because over the long term, it's going to destroy the union movement. Alan, you said it very well, and I appreciate the call. Gene in San Francisco, California, listening to KGRN. Hey, Gene.
Hi. Yeah, these reactionary Republicans, Tom, and the conservative Democrats, as you pointed out, too, they essentially destroy the freedom of the social economic mobility for the average citizen. They remove our freedoms.
That's their goal. Edmund Burke wrote about this in the 1780s. He had this long debate about this topic with actually with a number of Americans. But Thomas Paine was the biggest one, the author of Common Sense. Paine went over and spent 2 weeks living at Burke's house, staying at Burke's house on his way to France during the French Revolution. And they had such a fight that Thomas Paine wrote a book, an entire book called The Rights of Man, in rebuttal to Burke. And then Burke wrote a series of essays in rebuttal to Paine. Burke is the leading guy that today's conservatives still point to. The first chapter of Russell Kirk's book, The Conservative Mind, is all about Sir Edmund Burke. Today's conservatives still quote Burke. And Burke made it very clear that society, in order to be stable, must have orders and classes. That's his phrase, orders and classes. And there must not be great mobility among and between orders and classes, and that those orders and classes must be defined by economics.
And Paine realized that was a quiet violence against our dreams of bettering our lives. And he was our champion for that. Thank you so much for reintroducing the class discussion to the lexicon, because ever since the fear of all things socialistic and anti-communism, it's become taboo to speak about class structure in the United States.
Yeah. Well, it's people go, oh, you're sounding like Karl Marx. Well, you know, in some ways, actually, Karl Marx's analysis was correct. His prescription didn't work. It would work on a kibbutz. It works in a small community. It didn't work in an entire
nation. What they
want
us to have is a frozen society rather than a fluid society.
That's right, because it's stable. And this is where you go back and you look at the founders. You know, the United States, our republic, was a huge experiment in the beginning. And all around the world, everybody else was saying, no, this isn't going to work. And then the French Revolution broke out, and Jefferson originally thought that it was going to go the same way that ours did, and it would be a great thing. And that's when he said, you know, every now and then the tree of liberty needs to be watered by the blood of patriots, something that he later regretted saying.
All those past civilizations where the laborers did not share in the power, those were frozen societies that lacked all social and economic mobility. And Americans have to be reintroduced to that. Thank you so
absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely. You're welcome. And the big distinction between the French Revolution and the American Revolution is that the French Revolution was a revolution of people in absolute and utter poverty, whereas the American Revolution was a revolution by the middle class. And that's why the French Revolution collapsed, because they didn't have the institutions of civil society of, by, and for the middle class at that time. But perhaps we're getting a little too academic. 45 minutes past the hour. Stick around. We'll be back with more of your calls.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Jim at the L.A. Center. Now, L.A. Center is airport, is pilot lingo, or the part of the air traffic control system that controls the airspace around Los Angeles. Writes in and he says, I'm an air traffic controller at one of the nation's busiest facilities, Los Angeles Air Route Traffic Control Center, and I can tell you that our national airspace system is on the verge of implosion. Instead of upgrading our facilities and technology and personnel, as we did under Clinton, the Bush administration has made breaking the Air Traffic Controllers Union, NACTCA, NATCA, its number one priority. New hires are walking away from the job in startling numbers, and our most experienced controllers are retiring as fast as they can. Please get the word out. This is a national emergency that the Bush administration is lying about and hiding from. Jim at LA Center. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, no, if you can destroy a union in the process, they don't care what kind of damage is done to the United States. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, you remember the Petco destruction by Mr. Reagan. That was another great example of trying to break the airport unions. And actually, there is a bill in Congress right now, because in many of the small airports, they've hired private companies. And they've now been hired by Lockheed Martin. And what Lockheed Martin employees want to do is say, we want the same retirement benefits that we got when we were government employees.
Oh, boy.
And there's a bill in Congress to deal with just that. So this is it really has very broad implications. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, no, they want to privatize everything from our air traffic control system to Yellowstone.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the big issue at the White House today was this whole thing that has been going on about Turkey. And Condoleezza Rice came to the White House along with Secretary Gates and talked about the genocide, well, or the non-genocide campaign. As you know, there's a bill in Congress to declare what has happened in 1915 with Turkey as genocide. Well,
right. This is when the Turks. Now, just for background, and I've oddly around the Middle East. In fact, you see a lot of these posters in Jerusalem. You walk around, particularly in the old city in the Arab quarter. Don't forget the Armenian Holocaust. Apparently over a million Armenians were killed by the Turks in 1915.
That's right.
At least that's the claim that's made. And so this resolution was to acknowledge the death of the Armenians. And this is a real sore point with the Turks. They don't like this being discussed.
Well, it's a huge sore point, and in fact, today, Secretary Rice and Secretary Gates talked about how much we rely on Turkey, that pretty much all of our armored vehicles are sent through Turkish airspace, et cetera, that there is, 70% of certain of our arms come through there, and that the president, they say, has spoken and has issued a statement, the world must never forget history and what happened there, but won't use the word genocide. Well, very competent Ann Compton, president of the White House Correspondents Association, did a little Lexis research and said candidate Bush called it in February 2000 a genocidal campaign. What's changed? And Dana Perino said what essentially has changed is the presidential message should not be done through legislation. But it seems as if the Turks are really objecting to the word genocide versus what they called an unfortunate situation back in 1915.
Right, which, and they've been objecting to this for decades.
And, of course, now the question is the PKK in northern Iraq and whether the Turks are actually planning on going into Kurdistan or into the Kurdish part of Iraq. And that the White House is saying, well, this isn't the best place for Turkey to...
Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes even what you know isn't what's actually right.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind. Everything you know is wrong.
Well, the eternal question posed by the Fire Sign Theater. Michael Gilbert is with us. He's the author of The Disposable Male, Sex, Love, and Money, Your World Through Darwin's Eyes. Michael, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Is feminism destroying masculinity?
Well, I think it's certainly a hurt. We've spent now the better part of two generations tending to women, and I think we've gone possibly from the sublime to the ridiculous in the sense that we've overlooked men, and I think that they need some attention right now. I hasten to say,
why are the two mutually exclusive?
Well, they're not, and we should celebrate women's achievements. I think that's great. But if men are, you know, two out of five college students and not earning to the level that women are, this is not necessarily good for women either. I think that a strong, comfortable, easy masculinity is good for all of us.
Right. Reading your book, I get it that you're talking about, in fact, your subtitle, The World Through Darwin's Eyes,
mm-hmm.
that the basis of the arguments that you're making is basically evolutionary. I'm assuming you wouldn't challenge that.
That's correct.
Okay. So, and I'm assuming, as somebody who's familiar with evolution, you're familiar with the thing that Darwin's first eureka, the finches in the Galapagos Islands?
Correct, yes.
Okay, so what Darwin had noticed was that when the large seeds were in abundance, that the finches that had the larger beaks that could crack these larger seeds, their population dramatically increased to the point where eventually they ate down the population of, and they pushed out the smaller beaked finches, and until they ate down the large seeds, and there was nothing but small seeds left. With a large beak, they were at a disadvantage because it used more energy, and the small beaked finches came into ascendancy, and there was a cycle that went back and forth.
Right.
And it didn't imply a direct line of evolution, but it did show that there was this balance. Let me submit to you a thesis that I couldn't find in your book, and I don't think you're considering, and I'd love to get your take on it.
Mm-hmm.
We had in the world for the entire history of the human race, 165,000 years of the estimated history of the human race, fewer than a billion people until the year 1800.
Right.
In 1800, we hit our first 1 billion people. It only took 130 years to get our second billion people, 1930. It only took 30 years to get our third billion people. Now, keep in mind, 165,000 years for our first billion people, 30 years for our third billion people, 1960. In 1960, the year John Kennedy was inaugurated, we had half as many people on the planet as we have today.
Right.
The population of the United States was about half of what it is today. Our fourth billion people only took 14 years, as I recall, 1974. Our fifth billion, 13 years, 1987. Our sixth billion, only 11 years, 1999. We're now working on our seventh billion. Isn't it time for us to say maybe the seeds have changed, and like the finches on the Galapagos Islands, we should be studying the lessons of Darwin, and instead of trying to hearken back to traditional roles of male and female sexuality and gender and power that tend to produce large populations, which might have been adaptive back 4,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago when the population with the largest army or the tribe with the largest army was the one that survived. Instead of that, what we should be doing is we should be looking at ways to reduce our population.
Well, you're right. We're screaming up towards 7 billion in a great hurry. Malthus thought we were going to run out of food, and technology has kind of kept us in the game. But addressing your main point,
actually, oil is largely what's kept us in the game, and we're hitting the peak of that.
Right. That's true. You know, the issue really comes down to the fact that humans, males and females, we're carrying around millions of years of genes in our body. And although we can look at a problem like you're putting forward and say, yes, it makes a lot of sense, we ought to cut down on breeding, it doesn't translate to the individual person, whether they're here or they're in Kuala Lumpur. They want to have kids, and they're driven by these ancient issues. So even as we look forward to a more evolved state of the world, we still, this is really the point of the disposable male, we have to kind of honor, I think, we have to honor these issues, not go backwards so much, but accept the fact that we have an animal basis. We share 98% of our genes with the chimpanzee.
And so, yet you find when look at the rat studies from the 1950s and 1960s, the psychology studies that were done, where you found that when you overcrowd rats, they become violent, they become infertile, they start behaving, they actually stop reproducing.
Right.
And I would submit to you, and this is something you mentioned in your book, the fact that people are getting married later and they're having fewer children, and that it may actually be translating to the level of the individual, and that maybe there's nothing wrong with people saying, you know, I don't want to get married until I'm 35, and instead of having 10 kids, I want to have one.
Well, you know.
Or none at all.
Now, notwithstanding the fact that we're overpopulated, the reality is in a lot of countries we're underpopulated. Japan has not enough youngsters working who are going to be able to fuel and pay for the pension plans of the aging population. The same.
Well,
thing.
There are a lot of people in Japan who would dispute that. I mean, it's a nice talking point that is in particular pushed by the Catholics, but Japan doesn't seem all that concerned about it.
Well, they should be, because they're not really comfortable with immigration, and the Japanese women are just not reproducing at the 2.1 child per woman that is the maintenance level. We are in this country largely because of immigration, but in Europe and in parts of Europe, this is a serious problem, Tom. They may be overcrowding in China, and even there, families for generations have been trying to get around that one child issue with all manner of things. What you're saying, I think, makes great sense in a theoretical
What Japanese economists are suggesting is that as labor becomes more scarce in Japan, as the older generation begins to retire, which is happening right now, and it's also happening in Italy, and it's also happening in Switzerland,
right,
and it's also happening in some of the Scandinavian countries, and we're seeing this trend play out. As labor becomes more scarce, the price of labor goes up. As the price of labor goes up, the taxes derived from that labor goes up, and the ability to use that revenue to pay for the care of the elderly increases. What drops is the profits going to the corporations, because the cost of labor has gone up. In other words, the main force that is out there screaming and worried about the aging populations in these mature democracies are A, the people who have a religious dog in the fight, who, you know, and B, the corporatists, the people who say, no, wait a minute, we need cheap labor, and we can't have a diminishing labor pool, because that's going to drive up the cost of labor, and that's going to make it less profitable for the captains of industry.
Well, a lot of my reading suggests that demographers and social philosophers are worried about this, too. I understand that the burden may come.
But, I mean, look at the Black Death in Europe. It wiped out a third of Europe's population. And what did it produce over the five generations that followed that? The Renaissance, an explosion of wealth and prosperity, is a consequence of a radical and immediate diminution in population of young people.
Surely we're not going to be rooting for that anytime soon, for the plague to come back.
No, but my point is that when population diminishes, if you look at history, what you find is that when population diminishes, the ratio of population to resources improves on the side of the humans who are still around, and life actually gets better for everybody except those at the very top. On the other hand, when you have a massive population that exceeds the demand for labor, as Ricardo pointed out in 1816 in his book on labor, then what you have is a very small but very powerful and wealthy ruling class, and everybody else becomes serfs.
Right. Well, a good argument can be made. We're in that condition anyway right now. But
that's my point. That's my point. And that's why I'm saying maybe it's not a bad thing that we have these conditions that you're talking about in this book are causing people to marry later and not have children.
Right. It may not be a bad thing, but the power, I look at the world from, as you've pointed out, from the point of view of an evolutionist, and the power in our natural history, the drive, the genetic impulses that we have aren't going to disappear because somebody is making even a very reasonable argument about population control. the emerging countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, they're emerging into wealth, and people want family. They want kids. They want somebody to look after them when they get older. And so theoretical arguments about we don't need any more breeders or we can slow down the population growth doesn't translate to the desires of individuals in these cultures. It's really hard to say that after the Western cultures have enriched themselves, that the people in secondary cultures shouldn't enjoy larger families or more wealth. So I hear you. I think you're right. But I don't know how we translate that to the working men and women around the world.
Well, I think by empowering women, but that's a whole other argument. People can check it out on your website, thedisposablemail.com. Michael Gilbert, the author. Thank you for being with us, Mike.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Special call out to our listeners on Talk 1090 in Seattle. On the 26th, I'll be at the Elliott Bay Bookstore signing my new book, Cracking the Code, which is, by the way, out. It's not in all bookstores now, but it is online. It's on your various online stores. You can find a link off TomHartman.com to it, at least over at Amazon. There's other stores as well. And also at TomHartman.com and also on AirAmerica.com, there's a link to a survey we're doing. We're going to reinvent our website, try to make it more interactive and more useful and more interesting and whatnot. And we'd love to have your feedback, your thoughts on how it should be done. What are the things that you really would like out of it? So we'd appreciate it if you'd just take a few minutes and share your opinions with us. It's a little 2-page survey. So pretty straightforward stuff. Within days of his second coming, Jesus Christ, a.k.a. Prince of Peace, Savior of the Lord, is facing charges in a number of jurisdictions across the country, writes Nancy Greggs over at Democratic Underground. This is worthy of Andy Borowitz. After addressing a crowd in Washington, D.C. with what is quickly becoming known as his now infamous Blessed Are the Peacemakers speech, Jesus was arrested for holding a political rally without a permit. A possible charge of treason is also pending, given that the Lord's blatant anti-war statements may constitute a direct threat against the born-again president and his conduct of the war in Iraq. Later that same day in Orlando, Florida, Jesus was handcuffed by local authorities after feeding a multitude of homeless people who had gathered to hear him speak about being thy brother's keeper. The arresting officer said, "We still don't know how he pulled off the 7 loaves and 7 fishes thing, but the law is the law." In a related incident, Jesus was again at odds with local authorities in Fresno, California, after attempting to prevent police from destroying makeshift shelters constructed by the homeless. After being read his Miranda rights, the Lord's only comment was, "As you do unto the least among you, so you do unto me." Within minutes of posting bail, he reappeared at an Alabama state judicial building, where he was promptly arrested for inciting to riot after making a statement about rendering things unto Caesar and things unto God. One man, later identified as Judge Roy Moore, said, "I knew that kid was a troublemaker the minute he started shooting his mouth off about the separation of church and state." Judge Moore was outside the building protesting the removal of a granite monument displaying the Ten Commandments from the premises several years ago. And it continues. You can read it all about it over at democraticunderground.com. It's a hoot. It's a hoot. Who would be arresting Jesus if he came back? 1-866-303-2270, our number. Julie in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. Hey, Julie.
Hi.
You had the debates in your backyard last night. What'd you think of it?
Well, you know, I get so angry with Republicans, I'm afraid I can't watch them because I'm afraid I'd throw something at the television.
Okay.
I'm
understand.
Not kidding.
Yeah, I understand.
But at any rate, I'll tell you something. You know, here in Michigan, we've got a recession going on that's been going on since 9/11. We have the highest unemployment in the country, and we had the only economy that shrank last year. It's really bad here, and it's getting worse.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you something. People here in Michigan are really, really mad about the Democratic candidates pulling out. You know, I mean, I thought switching the date to begin with was a bad idea, but it doesn't matter. I'm stuck in the state, and so are all the rest of us, and yet these Democratic candidates are basically saying, tough. Well, I'll tell you something. Who was on the news when they showed the debates? Who was at the debates in Dearborn were a lot of University of Michigan students, people who are generally liberals. You're finding a lot of people, young people, everyone wants to change so badly. I'll tell you something. A lot of us are really worried that the Democratic candidates have handed the state with our 17 electoral votes over to the Republicans.
By refusing to participate in the early primaries, by saying we're not going to go along with that. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah, but even that pulling out of the state.
Yeah, but what Michigan did was they, you know, by saying we're not going to play by the rules, by the party rules.
Oh, I know.
You know, they shot themselves in the foot.
Oh, I agree with that, but that's not the way it's being perceived here. The problem is it's like a real slight to the state that's having the worst time in the nation.
Yeah.
They shouldn't have pulled out. I can understand them not seating the delegates. That people didn't have a problem with. It's the pulling out of the contest altogether. People can't even write in their names, even if it were to be ignored.
Yeah. Well,
people are furious here.
Yeah, you make a good point, Julian. Perhaps some sort of a rational middle ground should have been achieved. Thanks for calling in and raising that issue. Craig in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Craig.
Hi. I just had a tiny disagreement. Actually, I'm in San Jose, but that's okay. I had a tiny disagreement with you about whether we can separate economic power from political power, as your original guest was talking about. Wouldn't that be what public financing of campaigns would do?
It would move us substantially in that direction.
Yeah.
And that would be the goal of public financing of campaigns, and you're absolutely right. It's and thank you for pointing it out. To the extent that it's possible to do, you're always going to have the situation. I mean, right now here in Oregon, we've got this ballot initiative to increase cigarette taxes to pay for a health insurance program. Sound familiar? It's the same thing that's happening at the federal level when we're talking about doing it here at the state. And Philip Morris is in the state paying for all these ads. I mean, this is not a candidate, it's not primaries, but it's economic power in the political realm.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
The hour. Welcome back. Well, it's getting strange out there. Very strange. Vanessa Alicorn saw them at an anti-war rally in Lafayette Square last night, writes Rick Weiss in the Washington Post. He says, I heard someone say, oh, my God, look at those. The college senior from New Yorker called. I looked up and I said, what the hell is that? It looked like dragonflies or little helicopters. But, I mean, those are not insects. Out in the crowd, Bernard Crane saw them, too. I've never seen anything like it in my life, the Washington lawyer said. They were large for dragonflies. I thought, is that a mechanical or alive? No, I'm reading you a straight story out of the Washington Post here. This is just one of the questions hovering over a handful of similar sightings at political events in Washington and New York. Some suspect the insect-like drones are high-tech surveillance tools perhaps deployed by the Department of Homeland Security. Well, actually, instead of looking at the dragonflies, you should be looking at the pigeons. And as one of our listeners alerted us the other day, you ever seen a baby squirrel? No, you never see baby pigeons. Never see baby squirrels. I'm not quite sure about the squirrels yet, but the pigeons, I'm pretty sure. I've never seen a baby pigeon, never see a dead pigeon, Or if you do, it's probably a dressed-up dove made to look like a pigeon just to fool you, because pigeons are actually robotic spies from the planet Xenon, or is it Xenu, that are brought down every 6 months and dropped. That's why we're at, and then they take them up every 6 months and play back their tapes. That's why wherever there's a meeting, whether it's anti-war protesters or heads of state, there are pigeons. Speaking of the weird, Comcast, cable company here in Portland, Oregon, right here, Little Beirut. This is what George Herbert Walker Bush called our beautiful city. Comcast has decided, apparently, according to a story over at the Daily Kos, as well as other places, I mean, it's all over the web now, something that is sure to be discussed in local radio, I would suspect, here tomorrow in Portland. Comcast has decided to move one of the basic cable channels from basic cable to you-gotta-pay-for-it cable. Would that be Fox News? No. Would that be CNN? No. They got Glenn Beck. No, it's MSNBC. If you want to keep watching Keith Olbermann, you have to pay. Interesting. A lot of people very upset with Comcast. A lot of people starting to protest this, contacting Comcast. You can check out the website over at dailycos.com, the article about it. And, of course, comcast.com is their website. 866-303-2270. Speaking of Oregon, Ken in Salem, Oregon on the line. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Well, when you were talking about unions, it brought back a memory that I have. My parents were very anti-union, but in the mid-70s, I got a job in data processing, and it was paying quite a bit more than my previous job. And I asked my supervisor, you know, why is the pay so good? And he says, we're trying to keep unions out of here. So even though I didn't belong to a union, they were increasing my pay. And I think
right. The rule of thumb is that for every union job in an economy, there is one identical job because the union jobs provide the floor. So when we were at 35% unionization in 1947, roughly 70% of the American workforce had the equivalent of a union job. When we were at 25% unionization when Reagan came into office, roughly 50% of American workers had the equivalent of a union job. That was the era of the great middle class. Now we're down to 7% of the private workforce being unionized, which means about 14% of Americans have the equivalent of a union job. Thus, we're seeing the hollowing out of the infrastructure of the American middle class, the economic infrastructure.
Yeah, the other point that I wanted to make is I was watching the debate last night with the Republicans, and I had to turn it off when they started going after Social Security. And it made me think, though, that they might be making a mistake, because I'm on, like, the leading edge of the baby boom generation, and some of us are starting to look at Social Security as part of our retirement. And if they're talking about making cuts, baby boomers do tend to vote a lot. I think this might be a mistake on their part.
Yeah, I think Grandpa Fred shot himself in the foot last night, and a lot of the other Republicans have as well. I mean, this was George Bush campaigned on this in 1977 in Texas, running for the House of Representatives unsuccessfully. His main campaign platform was to privatize Social Security. This has been the absolute dream of conservatives ever since they first tried in 1938, 1939, several times legislatively in the early 40s. Even when the Republicans took to control the House and Senate in the election of 46 and 47, they tried to do away with Social Security. They've tried over and over and over again because they consider it socialism, and they have not been successful because the American people want it, and that's called democracy. Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Joe in a boat off the California coast. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Could I make a comment and a question?
Let's see.
Yeah.
Depends on how long it is and where you're going.
No, I'll make it brief. I'll have to agree with your lady that the insightful lady that called earlier about the House of Cards imploding on itself. I think what I'm seeing, all the young people and elderly people that I've been around lately, there's a public apathy that's just gone beyond the pale.
You're talking about a political apathy?
I'm calling it apathy because they just don't care. I mean, did you see the news clip last week? Exactly a week ago, I woke up to a news clip of a lady being cuffed and then repeatedly hit with tasers repeatedly every time she got up. And they didn't call it murder, and they said she was just manhandled. She died.
You talking about the woman in the Phoenix airport?
Yeah,
I don't believe that she was tasered.
Complete cover up on that. It was a test to see, like, how there's no caring about her mother or two. You know, they just, you know, I saw the news. Anyway, the CNN thing you're talking about and all that, the Comcast, they've been doing that down here in Central California for about 4 years now. You can't get any of those. You can't get MSN. You have to. They're all pay as you go,
right,
which I refuse to do.
As soon as the programming becomes even remotely liberal, then all of a sudden you got to pay for it. It's going to be a little harder to get. Good point, Joe, and well made. Roman in Long Island, New York. Hey, Roman.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I actually watched the debates as well last night. You know, one of the things I found fascinating is that I always considered, given this was an economic debate yesterday, that in the heart of Detroit, which is our manufacturing heyday, that the only question that even remotely seemed to try to address that was one that Mitt Romney sort of fumbled. None of the GOP seems to be interested in investing in anyone's future other than their own.
Absolutely. Well, that's because they don't believe that it's the role of government to invest or control investments. They think that there's this magical force out there, this mythical, invisible hand, a phrase that, by the way, only appears once in Adam Smith's 1776 book, The Wealth of Nations. And Smith, in fact, there's a number of great quotes from Wealth of Nations where Smith warns about the aggregation of corporate power, or the equivalent of what would have been called corporate power in 1776, probably thinking of the British East India Company at the time. But nonetheless, they believe in this sky god called the free market. And they think that this mythical, magical free market will solve all problems. And the free market is a sham. Markets come about because governments help create them. They authorize the existence of corporations. They create laws that define what is property and what isn't, and what the relative value of property is, how long you can have a patent for, how long you can have a copyright for, what the penalties are for the theft of property, or the taxes are on the transfer of property, things to encourage or discourage business in a whole variety of different ways. But these guys actually believe this fantasy.
But you look at the Nobel Prize today from a German won it in chemistry. Yesterday it was a Frenchman and a German in physics. There's a shift in intellectual ideas moving away from us to other parts of this globe.
Well, that's because in Germany or France, if you're a decent student, you can go to college all the way up to a PhD for free.
That's right. Yeah, I had a good friend of ours is sending their daughter to Germany for university. I'm actually from there, and it's one of the things you look at going, this is a brain drain now in reverse. We've never had to deal with this, and we're literally replacing that part of our population with undereducated people from other parts of the country.
And we used to have, it used to be the other way around in the United States.
That's right.
Roman, I'm going to drop the call because the echo is making me crazy, but thank you. You brought up a very important point, and that is that it was, again, Ronald Reagan. I mean, it all goes back to Ronald Reagan, right?
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
It all goes back to Reagan, and he literally put the beginning of the end to the New Deal. And it was Reagan who said, the University of California, free tuition. We can't have free tuition. Are you kidding? In fact, a reporter, when he was governor, he ended the free tuition at the University of California. And a reporter asked him afterwards why. And he said, why should I pay tuition so that some kid can protest something that I don't believe in? Well, because of free speech. Because universities are supposed to be places where discussion and debate is in ferment. They're supposed to be places where discussions are going on, where people are disagreed with. And because if you want to invest in the future of your country, you invest in education. You invest in your universities, in your students. But Reagan didn't believe in investing in the country because he didn't think that that was a role of government. He thought that the free market would magically take care of that. And 26 years later, we are now seeing how well it worked. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
our infrastructure's eroding. So what if levees break for disasters we're not ready? Bush thinks we'll just eat cake, 'cause a dollar is his true god. The people he'll forsake, business will carry on. Glory, glory, Halliburton. Glory, glory, Halliburton. Glory, glory, Halliburton. Business will carry on. Glory, glory, Halliburton.
Glory, yes, glory, glory, Halliburton. Perfect rewrite of the old classic song. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Melanie in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Melanie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about the Overman Comcast deal.
Right.
Comcast did the same thing in the Denver-Boulder area approximately, 5 months ago or so. And we all, you know, called and protested and did what we could to, because it seemed so suspicious that they were moving just, you know, Overman, the number one increasing cable news show, and no others. And that was our gut reaction too, that this was just not right. It was, they were trying to drag us, you know, all into the higher package.
And what did they say?
I'm sorry?
And what did they say when you protested?
They feigned complete innocence, and they had, you know, acted as if they had no idea we could ever think such a thing and that kind of stuff.
Did they move one of the C-SPAN channels into the paid for as well?
No. Oh,
no. Okay.
Well, no, they didn't.
Okay, because I've heard that, and that really baffled me, because I thought that C-SPAN was something that the cable companies had to. It was basically their way of paying for the commons of the rights of way that cable systems use.
Right. I just wanted to urge the people of Portland to try to make some noise about it, because I guess we didn't make enough, and they figured they could get away with it in other markets. So.
Yeah. Well, apparently they are. Melanie, thanks a lot for
the heads up.
It's much appreciated. Yeah, Abby, you know, you've got a show that's very, very popular. It's growing. It's doing well, and if your only job, if you perceive your only job to be to make money, then of course you want to jack up the price on it because you can make more money from it. And this brings us back to the question of, you know, broadcasting in the public good, even if it's cable, because it is using, cable systems use our public rights of way just like radio and television stations use our public airwaves. A cable system cannot exist if communities do not allow them to run their cables along public rights of way. CB in Santa Monica, California. Hey, CB.
Hey, Tom. You know, it used to be that if they wanted to declare war, if Congress or the president wanted to declare war, they'd say, we need to raise taxes, and they'd go to the American people. We know that everybody would say no to that. So their solution was to come up with the Federal Reserve Act so that we could have a fiat fractional currency that they could inflate. Your commercial says, have you noticed how new dollars central banks are printing? The reason they're doing that is to finance the war without having to ask the American people.
Not just the war, and the result of this is going to be the exact same thing that happened when we had the Vietnam War being paid for by debt, and then we had to start paying those debts in the 1970s after the Vietnam War was over, and Jimmy Carter suddenly is president, and the economy is going to hell, and interest rates are going up to 16%, 18%, 20%, and inflation's going through the roof. Why? Because we were paying the bill essentially of the Vietnam War, and the government was paying it with deflated dollars or inflated dollars, you know, deflated value. And you're absolutely right.
And income tax is what they use to pay for the interest on that. It doesn't do highways. It doesn't do new signs. It doesn't do schools. It just pays the interest on the tax that is generated by the Federal Reserve Act.
Yeah.
I've been a Democrat all my life, and I am totally inspired by Ron Paul. And I think that he will increase the capabilities or the lifestyle of the American people, but in a different way than you discuss. And I think you sell him short. He wants to eliminate income tax, which didn't exist before 1913. And he wants
actually,
to eliminate
Abraham Lincoln
Federal
put
Reserve
into place
Act.
The first income tax.
And he wants to eliminate the Federal Reserve Act. So these two strokes of a pen are monumental increases in the lifestyle of the middle class.
Yeah. First of all, doing away with an income tax is not going to change the lifestyle of the middle class. Because if employers right now, let's say that you're making $50,000 a year, and your employer knows that you're actually taking home $35,000 after taxes. So now all of a sudden the taxes all go away. You think your employer is going to continue paying you $50,000 a year when they know that you'll work for $35,000?
That I couldn't say.
Well, I can say. If your employer knows that you will work for $35,000 take-home pay, when the taxes get cut, so is your pay. It's going to be cut. The only people who benefit from tax cuts are the very, very top, the people who can throw that money in.
What about tax cuts? What about tax elimination? See,
when we're talking about income taxes, the only people who would benefit are people in that category.
Americans should keep more of their wealth if they are not taxed. You know, if we don't have to give a third of our stuff away.
But it's not our stuff. We have the infrastructure of the United States. We have this nation. We have a national park system. We have roads. We have police. We have fire. We have all these things. And I acknowledge that some of this is paid for with property taxes and some paid for with sales tax. But much of the infrastructure of the United States, certainly the intellectual infrastructure of the United States, is paid for with income taxes. And if you do away with that, then, yeah, it will be the United States that Ron Paul and libertarians want. But I don't think it's the United States that most Americans want.
Well, how do you feel about going back to the gold standard and the silver standard? As I understand it, that means that the money would be really worth something and that they couldn't just go printing more money whenever they felt like willy-nilly having a war.
I think it's something we should very seriously consider. And I think that one of the reasons that Nixon took us off the gold standard in 72 was because he saw it coming, that the bill was going to come due for the Vietnam War. It was going to have to be paid off, and he wanted to be able to pay it off in dollars that were worth less than they were when they were originally borrowed during the war that he extended, you know, to get himself reelected over a second.
There's a great education in all this over at libertydollar.org and by reading Edward Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island.
The Creature from Jekyll Island actually is
LibertyDollar.org, Ron Paul.
Love you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, CB. Good talking to you. Coming up tomorrow, Jimmy Carter is going to be here on his new book, Beyond the White House, Waging Peace, Fighting Disease, Building Hope. Eric Pratt and I will be debating whether vets with PTSD should be in a federal criminal database barring them from purchasing guns. Christy Harvey on News Below the Radar. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there, get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.